This is an ABC podcast.
We've got all this produce that was going to go to waste. We thought we might as well get in there, cook it up, and take it to the family centre so that some of their families that are struggling, probably more so now than ever, could have some meals. So that sort of went from there, and it happened very quickly, and it got very big very quickly.
It started with one phone call. Shortly, we'll hear how a community banded together to provide hundreds of free meals every week to those in need and struggling through COVID restrictions. And we take to the skies with some of the growing number of female hot air balloon pilots who couldn't imagine doing anything else.
It was the lifestyle. I mean, like, there's no way that you can complain about getting up in the sky and having that as your office. So when that was kind of an option to be a job, there was no way I was going to turn it down.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. We start tonight in regional New South Wales and a story that looks at the challenges faced by small businesses when it comes to requiring customers and clients to be vaccinated. This comes as lockdown areas, some anyway, start to open up. Like many other small businesses across New South Wales, the owners of the Kerwa Caravan Park are desperate to welcome back patrons after a quiet 18 months. The park's owners, however, are particularly concerned about COVID-19, so they've also announced they will soon introduce a mandatory vaccination policy on their guests. While they say it's a decision based on safety, mateship and the Australian way, the feedback on social media has been vicious. Mildura reporter Richard Crabtree has this report.
The Kerwa Caravan Park is situated on the banks of the Murray River, just on the border of New South Wales and Victoria. Rick Young is the owner of the park, and I spoke with him in Rona's Kitchen, a communal cooking area named after Rick's late mother, who passed away in 2017. When she died, Rick's father, Brian, moved into a cabin at the caravan park to be closer to his son. Brian is now 78 years old, and he says he has COPD, a chronic lung disease.
I run out of breath fairly quickly. I fatigue very easily. So having something like COVID flying around, I'm already 50% there. And if I get COVID, that'll be the end of that.
It's partly because of Brian's illness that Rick announced a new policy at the park. Soon, they will only be accepting customers who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19.
We thought that we've got my dad living here who's not well. We maybe should do the right thing, decide, right, this is what we believe, this is what we want to do, we need to keep everybody safe.
The policy is also in line with the New South Wales roadmap out of lockdown. Domestic travel will soon be open for the entire state, but only for those who are fully vaccinated. For Brian, a rule mandating vaccination makes total sense.
To me, it's a natural thing. You know, people say it's discriminatory and all this sort of stuff, but really, if you want to be safe, you do what's best to be safe. And currently, that's double vaccine.
Yet when Rick announced the park's decision on Facebook, the reaction and the abuse was swift.
Our first comment took about 15 seconds, and it absolutely hammered us. We expected some negative comments, and we expected and accepted that. That's fine. But to the degree that it was and is and still is phenomenal. My wife and I were sitting there and we're actually quite stunned, quite shocked. You know, I can't believe people would talk to other people like that. And it was just mind-blowing.
But Rick presumes the comments and vitriol are from a vocal minority, highly organised on social media, but not representative of the broader picture. He says the support they've received in private is enough to reassure him they're making the right call.
I did question whether we should leave the post up. And then my wife said, why are we going to budge? This is our business. This is what we've been building for 5 years. These are our beliefs. We're not taking down the post. And we didn't. And it was the next morning we actually received a private email through our website supporting our decisions, saying, once the borders are open, we're coming to visit you. I printed that out. I've got a copy of it proudly on my desk. And we read that and thought, it's all worth it. And if people want to keep going on about us, about, you know, threatening to sue us and we're being discriminatory and how un-Australian, yeah, well, I disagree totally. How can it be un-Australian to look out for your mate? Isn't that what Australia is all about?
That's the owner of the Kurlwa Caravan Park, Rick Young, speaking with Richard Crabtree.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
It started with one phone call. Now the community at Tweed Heads on the Queensland-New South Wales border has banded together to provide hundreds of free meals every week to those in need. The Twin Towns area, as it's known, has been particularly hard hit by COVID restrictions, with families divided by border barriers and many businesses not able to open or making barely enough to survive. Gold Coast reporter Kathy Border has the story.
Today we have the chicken ragu with veggies and rice. And we've got the classic bangers and mash with veggies.
An employee of Seagulls Club at Tweed Heads on the New South Wales-Queensland border, Craig Geary is one of many volunteers helping to distribute food to those feeling the pinch. Marketing manager Arawa Wesner says no questions are asked. It started with the first round of lockdown.
How can we help the community with meals? We've got all this produce that was going to go to waste. We thought we might as well get in there, cook it up, and take it to the family centre so that some of their families that are struggling, probably more so now than ever, could have some meals. So that sort of went from there, and it happened very quickly, and it got very big very quickly. And I'm on the phone to Joe going, we want to bring 200 meals 5 days a week. And everybody was a bit shocked, like, what do you want to do?
They teamed up with the family centre. It normally helps community needs, but Joe Blanchard says this took it to a whole new level.
I guess the first day we handed out the meals, we were mainly dealing with family centre participants. So everyone was quite, wow, these meals are going into our food boxes. And we were kind of putting the word out there that this was happening. So that was the Wednesday when we first started. And the Friday, we were completely overwhelmed. All the meals went. We did 300 that Friday, and they were gone within the 2 hours of turning up.
You're connected with St. Joseph's, with the church community here. Have you seen a lot of people that you normally would through the church, or others have turned up as well?
We put a call out to the St. Joseph's church community to take up the service, because they've been very kind to us and lent us their commercial kitchen next door to store the food. But mainly we've seen older community members come in, people that we would normally not see in our service because they don't fit the demographic of the people that we work with.
Are some people embarrassed to accept the help?
Yeah, I think some people have never been in that position before, and they've turned up, you know, telling us they haven't been in that position, and the reason they're in the position is because they work in Queensland, but they live in New South Wales. It's obviously a need since I think we've only been going for just under 2 weeks, and we've given out 1,700 meals.
So it was specifically for lockdown, but you know the need is going to be there past that.
Look, the need's always been here in this community. It's just come to the forefront now in this crisis.
A grateful Sophie Russell is a mental health support worker.
So the clients I support, unfortunately, are not in the best financial position. So these meals really actually go a long way to keeping their money going for the longest period and getting like the nutrition that they really need. Otherwise, they unfortunately don't usually buy the best stuff. So these meals really help them daily.
What are they saying to you about their daily struggle with life at the moment?
A lot of it's just isolation. So they really rely heavily on being able to get out and about in the community. And with the lockdowns and everything like that, that really hinders that. Their anxiety, obviously, around these sort of issues are heightened at the best of times, let alone when it's everywhere, all over the news and things like that.
What does it mean that a service like this exists?
Oh, we would be completely lost without them. Just the support and the benefit that we get daily for ourselves and our clients is just astronomical, so we'd be lost without them.
That's mental health support worker Sophie Russell on how the Tweed food packages are helping her clients. That report by Gold Coast reporter Kathy Border.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman, in for Sinead Mangan. It's wonderful to have your company. Buffalo meat has been described as Wagyu of the top end and a cheaper alternative to beef. In the Northern Territory, there's an abundance of the animals, but not all of them are destined for a food market. Top End station manager Adrian Phillips is known as a bit of a buffalo whisperer. The former chopper pilot, contract musterer and butcher credits buffalo to giving him a foot up in life. Landline's Christy O'Brien reports.
Yeah, back then, like, I didn't have 2 cents to rub in my name, really, when I started, eh? And it was dangerous, you know, and running portable yards and doing that all up through Arnhem Land. I caught cattle, quite a lot of cattle, you know, scrub bulls, contract mastering and all that, but it was the buffalo that I made money out of, you know, black gold in the territory, eh?
Rode
on the buffalo's back. Yeah.
Buffalo have a checkered history here. They've been roaming in the Top End for more than 150 years. After being introduced, as early as 1825, to use for labour and also their meat. Many of these outlying settlements were abandoned in the mid-1900s, but the buffaloes set up camp permanently. The tuberculosis crisis wiped many out, but it didn't take long for numbers to climb right back up.
Where the administration is researching the possibility of setting up a large-scale buffalo meat industry for human consumption.
Initially, we had meatworks way back then, you know, supplying Catherine and bachelor abattoirs back in them days. So it was pretty good there initially, like it wasn't bad. And then we lost our abattoirs. That made a big change.
Adrian runs 700 buffalo alongside 3,500 cattle. He says the numbers could be higher.
I could easily run probably 3,000 buffalo on top of 4,000 head of cattle.
But it's not cattle where he spies opportunity. He thinks the buffalo trade is on the precipice of finally getting a good foothold. And he's not alone. Louise Bilardo heads up the NT's Buffalo Industry Council and has been advocating for the industry for the past 4 years.
There's been ups and downs in the industry, and we really feel that this is a period of huge opportunity where the industry can have a whole series of disparate aspects come together, and part of that's because of the high price of cattle, and the other is the opportunities to the north in Southeast Asia.
What has changed is we have an abattoir that is operational. That is the one big thing that has changed. That has now gone from 20% or 30% of the animals could be sold to now, nearly 100% could be sold.
While buffalo still only commands half of what cattle fetch, the reduction in the national beef herd to the lowest levels in 20 years could see demand for buffalo as a cheap alternative rise.
Certainly in Southeast Asia, the emphasis is on red meat, and buffalo and cattle are essentially one and the same, but do have different price points in the wet markets especially. And so the Northern Territory buffalo meat is seen as top of the range.
But demand far outstrips supply, and it's not because of a lack of animals. Currently, thousands of buffalo are culled every year to keep numbers down, particularly on Indigenous lands.
Yes, we need to manage numbers because it does create an environmental impact, and we see that. But hey, let's get together and get contractors out there. Some of the best stockmen I've ever employed out there catching and mustering are Indigenous. This is a great opportunity to get some real work happening in their country. But here's an opportunity. Let's run. All this bullshit been going around in circles forever about trying to create employment on communities, on country. Most of the buffalo are on country. Let's make it work.
He also wants to see more pastoralists doing what he is, trading free-range buffalo, holding on to them, and offloading during wet season when contract mustering crews can't access Arnhem Land. At Enabru, they aren't putting all the eggs in just one buffalo market, though. Adrian purchased some of the Agricultural Department's research herd and wants to utilise the genetics to breed what he thinks could be a high-end meat.
I call it top-end Wagyu. Yeah, look, it's good eating beef, you can cook it properly, but there's a lot with it, you know. We're looking the feed they're on and what they're doing to get them at such a young age to that weight. The riverine buffalo grow about 30% quicker than the Asian water buffalo and things like that, and they hold a white fat, good white fat. They are different.
That's Adrian Phillips ending that report by Christy O'Brien. And you can watch Christy's full story on Landline on ABC TV this Sunday from 12:30 in the afternoon or any time on ABC iView.
This week on Landline, why don't Australians want to do the heavy lifting on farms?
The opportunities in Australia for young people, there's so many opportunities. The idea of packing avocados in a tray 8 hours a day, 5 days a week is probably not overly appealing.
Controlling nitrogen runoff from the booming blueberry business, and could buffalo be the territory's black gold? That's Landline 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
And right now you are on Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman. For a long time, hot air ballooning has been a male-dominated industry, with traditional balloons taking a lot of muscle to operate. But a growing number of female pilots are encouraging other women to take up the sport. Goulburn Murray reporter Charmaine Allison got up before sunrise and braved the cold to meet a couple of the pilots out as they got their day started.
It's 5 a.m. on a chilly Tuesday morning at Mansfield in northern Victoria when a bright flame lights up the darkness. Bronnie Bowen is standing in a hot air balloon basket next to her best friend, Georgia Croft. Georgia has been ballooning for 3 years, and today she hopes to bring Bronnie into the fold.
Nervous a little bit. I just had to take some deep breaths after the inflation just to get everything back in order. But yeah, no, I'm feeling confident.
Georgia is a rarity in a male-dominated business. As one of just 5 female commercial hot air balloon pilots Australia-wide, she was introduced to the sport by a friend and instantly abandoned her undergraduate studies in anthropology to focus on meteorology and microclimates instead.
It was the lifestyle. I mean, there's no way that you can complain about getting up in the sky and having that as your office. So when that was kind of an option to be a job, there was no way I was going to turn it down.
When she started, Georgia had only heard of one other female pilot.
It was actually required quite a lot of muscle in order to fly hot air balloons because the amount of pressure in order to operate them and pull the valves and release. So I have heard that it was actually much too difficult for a female to actually have the physical strength in able to operate them.
But sleek new hot air balloon designs have changed the game. And now Georgia is calling for more women to join the sport.
There's a lot of older males, and they're your kind of main conglomerate of hot air balloon pilots. And then there's sort of the kids of those guys that are the younger generation coming up. But getting youth involved and having that also a lot of female energy around, I think it will really revolutionise the sport.
Scarlett Saunders is also among Australia's few female commercial hot air balloon pilots. She was just 15 when her dad, global ballooning owner Kif Saunders, started teaching her to fly. At 18, she set a women's altitude record, flying a balloon 23,700 feet, that's 7 kilometres, off the ground.
I was in year 12 actually, in the school holidays. It was a bit cold up there. It was got to, I think, -7, but I did have my big ski jacket on. I did have to have an oxygen mask as well. It's an adventurous sport, and I mean, whenever I tell people that I'm a hot air balloonist, they always are just so amazed.
Floating over Mansfield's rolling hills, Bronnie looks right at home and well on her way to becoming the newest member of Australia's small ballooning sisterhood.
I just want it to be in my life.
All 3 women love ballooning for its close-knit community. Scarlett hopes she can one day take her passion overseas, flying balloons in different countries. Meanwhile, Georgia wants to test her skills against the world's best pilots at international competitions. But for now, the pandemic has kept those dreams and the ballooning industry as a whole on the ground.
Just having that shared experience and not getting the opportunity to kind of see the world from above in the way that we love has been a really big loss.
But while she waits for the world to reopen, Georgia hopes to continue helping others see their dreams take off.
That was Goulburn Murray reporter Charmaine Allison finishing that story about emerging female hot air balloon pilots. And finally tonight, when the Badger Forest Fire tore through hundreds of properties and homes on the far south coast of New South Wales, woodfire potter Daniel Lafferty was well prepared to defend his home. But he was forced to let his nearby pottery studio in Cobargo burn to the ground, destroying all his equipment, 5 months of pots waiting to be fired and decades of collected works. After a busy 18 months clearing the property, rebuilding fences and installing a new shed, he was finally ready to prepare for a firing, transforming over 600 kilos of clay into enough works to fill his hand-built kiln and gathering and split wood for the firing. Bigger reporter Vanessa Milton followed Daniel as he made the final preparations and was joined by friends and fellow potters for the marathon 100-hour firing.
Being a woodfire potter, well, I was always a believer of fire is your friend. You can use it as a tool. And I still feel fire is a friend. But they're not all friendly, are they? So, yeah. We got burnt down in the 2020 bushfires here at Cobargo. We came to this studio area, but there was a lot of firewood stacked here. I was ready to do a firing. It was all up by the buildings. And then we went to our house and stayed up there as the fire front came through and protected our house. So we came back to this studio, you know, after an hour or two, when we thought, oh, the house is right here. And no, everything was on fire, and we didn't even drive in the gate. We just had a look from the gateway and thought, it's too dangerous to go down there, and there's nothing you can do anyway, so we just let it all burn. We had a studio full of pots ready to do a firing, all the wood to do a firing. That's about, you know, 5 months' worth of working, yeah. And it destroyed all of it. Nothing of that survived. I haven't done a firing for 2 years now. I did have still a bit of a trickle of an income because there was always work out there that didn't get destroyed. But as that sold, I had nothing to replace it with. I've got a gallery in Sydney, one in Mittagong, a few local ones down here. This work in this kiln is to replace those shops and galleries I had. So, yeah, it's important to me to get a good lot of pots as I've got some quality work to take out again. There'd be about 600 kilos of clay made into pots, or 700 kilos of clay, but there's probably 500, 600, 700 pieces in there. And it's a bit like returning to the beginning, yeah. It's fairly frustrating, there's no doubt about it, especially when you're doing jobs you know you've done before. This firing we're doing, it's going to take us about 100 hours. We start with a fire on the outside of the kiln, letting it just suck in the air holes, and then we put a fire in the chamber. We'd like to have a crew of 6 people, and we split it into 3 8-hour shifts. It's a very natural process, and it's all about the flame travelling through the kiln and depositing ash in the firing, and how you fire your kiln and the fuel you use is what determines what the surfaces and the colours are like. That makes everything individual, so every pot in there is going to be different to the one beside it. This is day 3 now. It's probably about 1,200 degrees in there. It needs to burn for a little bit more. You've got to get to 1,300, even if they're 20 or 30 degrees short, it's going to be noticeably short. Well, be half of the wood is used just in the last 100 degrees, and half of the time. So the last 40 hours, it'll take us probably 40 hours to get 100 degrees now. We're about 95 or 100 hours in, and we've got 1,320 degrees in the front and probably 1,280 to 1,300 degrees up in the main chamber. These guys are having a big stoke to finish it off.
Beautiful!
You always have ideas in your head of how good it could be, and then it takes you a week or two to get used to it. You've got to learn to live with them for a little while. They look nice. I feel good in your hand. They've got a fair few dollars in there. It's like money in the bank. But, you know, dollars to effort, no. Too much effort. It's just a love of the process, really. You're working with Mother Nature because it's all the elements of earth, water, fire. It's nice to be creating things through fire. we need it as a tool.
That was Cobargo Woodfire potter Daniel Lafferty speaking to Bega reporter Vanessa Milton. That's 18 months after his Cobargo studio that Daniel rebuilt, and Vanessa was there to capture it when he finally began firing his kiln again to transform 600 kilos of clay into his pottery works. Good on him. And that is Australia Wide for this Thursday. I'm Alex Hyman. Hope you can join me tomorrow. Have a great evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.